Good evening, coming to you from Heathensburg, Pennsylvania. This is Doubting Dogma. I'm your host, Molly Ann Mormon, and coming from, St. Paul, right?
Yeah.
Minnesota. Is Riss McCool. Welcome, yes. Riss.
Coming back to you from the place in the place named after a Catholic saint, and of course, apparently the reason that this show gets an explicit label, I am here.
And then joining us are resident across the country expert on Mormon history, because the church won't tell us what really happened, Bryce Blankenengel. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm pretty stoked to talk about Mormon history with a fellow Molly ex-Mormon. This is always a fun opportunity.
And then I'm here too. Yay!
Riss too.
Yeah.
For a little back behind the scenes for all the listeners, we just spent the last 20 minutes talking back and forth, and Riss is just like, I am learning so much right now. It's a whole insular thing.
I can tell. I thought I had actually learned something before. Nope. I'm in class.
It's really like a foreign language. It's insane.
It even has its own phrase. Mormonese. That's a real thing.
Yeah, I was listening to your show, and you were there saying, when you were talking about the Book of Mormon and how the priestcrafts was like a Mormon thing, and how David Michael was like, what is that? And I was like, that's a Mormon thing? That's not really a thing? I was like completely shocked. I was like, what?
There are so many things that I run into talking. I don't talk to many Christians anymore, but a lot of ex-Christian atheists, and I just say something in passing that's totally only Mormon, and I thought it was like broad Christianity. Like, Jesus bleeding from every pore in the Garden of Gethsemane. Apparently, that's a whole completely only Mormon thing, and I had no idea. What? That's crazy, isn't it?
And I'm sitting here going, Gethsemane, Jesus bleed through the thing. I'm helping.
Well, I remember in seminary, like when we were talking about this, our teacher would say, okay, now if you would take a rubber band and put it around your finger really tight so it starts turning red, if you keep it there and then it starts turning purple and you keep it there some more and like blah, 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 and eventually you will drip blood out of your pore and the pain of that is enough to make you faint. And he did this from every pore. So think how bad his suffering was. And that was for you.
Yeah, yeah. Seminary. Bastion of science and medical research that is seminary.
Yeah, and my mind unfortunately went to the wrong place because I heard in seminary and thought, I heard it as one word and thought something completely different. And I was about to say, well, that explains why there's so many freaking Mormon children.
Well, no, because that's like sinning. Apparently, because I'm 36, just got married last year. So as you can imagine, Mormon, not married yet. I am the failure that is, you know, the bane of my parents' existence or something, because I don't have little heathen children yet or something.
And then you hired a queer to film your wedding, too.
Well,
so.
Yeah, we're not talking about that, but for a while there, and it was before I left the church, but I mean, I was in like such a lonely place, and I was just getting out of this abusive relationship and everything, and I was thinking, you know, I don't know that I'm ever going to have a family if I try and find a man. So I was considering like actually going and getting a donor, do that, and then I'd have a kid, not have to worry about, you know, baby daddy out there somewhere or any of that. And at one point when I was talking to my parents, and this was, well, I didn't talk to them about that, but there was another issue that I talked to them and mentioned it. And apparently even that is considered like adultery, because it's still having a kid with someone not your husband out of wedlock.
Dear Christ.
Yeah.
I mean... How great is that? I mean, just wow. But that just shows the damage when you base an entire person's existence on their womb. Like, the value of your existence, Molly, as a believing Mormon was how many babies you can spit out. It's not your career, it's not your passion, it's not your job, it's not any of what you take delight and pleasure in your life. No, it's for how many babies you can make.
Well, my sister has 7, so she made up for me.
Yeah, and in your story there, I've recorded 4 podcasts in the last 24 hours, so I got confused for a brief second about which podcast I was on, and when you said you couldn't find a husband, my mind went to, so you were going to try a chick? Like, you know, so I was on the cyst getting...
Maybe, don't
I'm on
judge.
The cyst getting out of hand, and I wouldn't judge, but, you know, I was already on all the gay shit shows, so now I got to get my mind in Mormon stuff. Which is totally not gay.
Yeah, totes not gay.
No.
We have magic underwear. That's not gay.
Oh, I mean, what's less gay than having your founding prophet have 35 wives? I mean, come on.
It's not overcompensation at all.
All right, so... Bryce, I wanted to have you on so we could talk a bit about your experience growing up Mormon, because you grew up in Utah, which is a whole different world than where I grew up, because, I mean, I was the only Mormon in my school, and I remember in, like, second grade, I don't remember why the teacher asked, but there was something having to do with, like, probably our history class or something about church, and she asked, well, who goes to church? And almost the whole class raised their hand, and I was so confused, because I was like, but they're just not.
Yeah.
I'm like, they're not in my church. I can tell by the way they act. They're not Mormons. You know,
you saw some porn shoulders out there, right?
Yeah.
You knew. But,
I mean, it was crazy, because at the same time, every time we went to church, we passed a Catholic church. So I knew there were other churches, but at the same time, like, that completely blew my little 7-year-old mind that there were people that had churches other than ours. And so growing up in Utah, we're literally, what, like 50% in Salt Lake and like 70% in the rest of the state is Mormon.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh.
It's a whole different experience too. And like the... It's weird to do this being part of the insular society, but you can stigmatize Mormons based on where they came from. You're like, oh, you're a California yes. Mormon? You're one of those hippie Mormons that, you know, that your parents might drink wine on the weekends or something like that. But like Utah Mormon, that's a stigmatized version of Mormonism, because
they are the hoity-toity. They're
holier-than-thou.
Well, we're here.
Mm-hmm. Well, Where this is all, Zion. Yeah. This is the Zion that Brigham Young built when he came across the plains, and that they have, you know, 24th of July parades every year for the Days of 47 rodeo, and like these yes. other celebrations that are not celebrated anywhere else in the world except for in Utah, because they have a connection to Mormon history somehow.
Pioneer Day.
Yeah, Pioneer Days. Yeah, and there are a bunch of like you know, heritage park, you know, that's in Salt Lake City. It's this, you know, kind of a fun little what can you call it, an amusement park, and there are just statues. There's this massive, you know, like 50-foot tall monument of Brigham Young overlooking the Salt Lake Valley saying this is the place,
this is
which
the
is
place.
Not even what he actually yeah. said when he crested the mountain. Like there's so much there that's only Mormonism. And there's, you know, anything in Utah is inextricably tied from Mormonism. There's absolutely no way to separate them out.
Yeah,
and that was...
Sorry. That would explain a lot, considering how I was treated there recently. So knowing that definitely puts things into a bit of a context.
Yeah, definitely. And anybody that's an outsider, that's not are they... It's not necessarily that Mormons... you know, consciously think I'm better than you. It's just that they are taught that the Mormon religion is the best out of all of them, And that goes to the foundation that, you know, you're aware of, Molly. It's like when the when God and Jesus appear to your founding prophet and say that all the religions are evil and their professors are corrupt, it kind of creates a certain air how you carry yourself when you're dealing with anybody that's part of that corrupt world out there. So, you know, where you grew up, Molly, you know, in Colorado, everybody around you wasn't in church, and you're like, they're not members. It was the complete opposite for me.
Yeah.
It was weird to me to see somebody in my church, or sorry, in school or something, and find out that they were not Mormon. That just seems so weird to me. Really, it's a concept that I didn't quite wrap my mind around until I moved out to Colorado as well. That's when I started driving a truck around Colorado, and you know, you don't see a Mormon church on every single block. When you do pass one, you're like, "Holy shit, that was a Mormon church!" That's like a unicorn out here. I mean, anywhere you go outside of Utah, it's like, "What the hell are the Mormons?"
Yeah, like I was saying in the previous segment, I didn't know what a Mormon was until I was 16, and that was just because a girl was interested in me, and somebody said, "You know, she's a Mormon, right?" I'm like, "What does that mean?"
Yeah, it's being on the outside of it is definitely it's offered some new perspectives and broadened horizons in my own life very much.
How so?
Well, in seeing that Mormonism isn't everything. I mean, when you're in the church, Mormonism isn't
everything.
Just where you go on Sunday and see, go to church for 3 hours on Sunday and then it's all over with. It's an entire culture. It's the way that you treat everybody around you as an insider. It's so much of what you do and say, and it's not just Sundays either. You know, when you're a teenager in the church, you go to to my maids, or you know, to young women's, or to young men's, or to scouts, or whatever. So you're engaged on some day in the week going to church and meeting with your friends and your fellow Mormons, and then you see them on Sunday, and then you see them at school every single day of the week. There's no separating the church friends from the school friends, because everybody is all a member of the same group. Now, granted, that does have its social benefits. You know, I credit the church and my upbringing all the time with giving me social structure and socializing with, you know, the other sex a lot more than I otherwise might have had I not grown up with that structure. But it also creates a bit of a self-policing system as well, because you have the groups of friends that you know your parents approve of, and then the group that you know that you don't want your family members to see you rolling around with, the bad kids or whatever. And they're, you know, these groups are stigmatized, and everybody in the neighborhood knows which are the good kids and the bad kids. And, you know, it's a cult. It's a cult just as much as it's a culture. You know?
That's interesting, because one of the first depictions that was not by Trey Parker and Matt Stone that I ever saw of Mormons was in a show called Hell on Wheels. And there's a part of that show where the main character knocks up a Mormon girl and has to come join the compound. And I mean, I know this is like 1870s, but I remember seeing that they treated the character like shit even after he agreed to stay in the compound because of what he did and marry the daughter, and every single one of them treated him like an outsider no matter how long he was there. And I was like, is that really how it is? So to hear this is like, yeah, it really is how it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not necessarily explicitly taught that way, that you're supposed to treat somebody like an outsider, but when you only treat insiders a certain way as your friends and colleagues, inevitably, you're going to treat outsiders differently.
Fascinating. Molly, you were saying about how you were the only one. So how did that dynamic play into it? Like, what was it like to be surrounded by the people who weren't insiders?
It was weird. And I'm completely socially awkward because I don't make friends, and I wouldn't see him at church, and even at church, because, you know, there were so few people my age. Like, my Sunday school class was like four people, and one of them was a guy, so my young women's class was three of us, and there were never more than that. So it was really difficult as far as like the friendships go, because there was almost no one my age.
Hmm.
Those that were, just, I don't know. There was never, any sort of close friendship or anything. We never went to hang out outside of, okay, we're there at our young women's mutual on Wednesday night, and okay, it's the first Saturday of the month, so we have our little church dance on Saturday at such and such a stake center. And
church dance with four people?
Well, no, it was for like the full.
Okay.
It was the, they usually had not just the stake, which is several wards, but it was like they'd have like three stakes together, and so all the Jesus. Youth. So they.
This is so fascinating. I'm learning so much.
Well, and that's how they keep it insulated too. Is they have these social group hangouts where only people that are members of the church are getting together. And that's kind of where you're taught that it's a safe space. You know, you can let down your guard, and anybody who's around you, they're chased. You don't have to worry about the pressure of getting in each other's pants. And like, you know, stake dances are a safe place. That's where you have to be able to fit a Book of Mormon
safe
edgewise.
Safe room for the Book of Mormon. Yep.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Oh, see, we had that. It was just safe room for Jesus.
No, see, I guess we didn't care about Jesus. It was all about the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, but. Right.
Well, that says a lot.
Yeah. And that's one thing that a lot of Christians crusade against the Mormon church about is, oh, you know, go to any church and listen to how many times they talk about Joseph versus Jesus. And I'm like, well, they're both crazy religious zealots, and they've both caused a lot of damage in their time. So...
There's go to that. The first five chapters of the Book of Mormon and tell me how
no.
many times you count hell.
I don't want to do this again.
No, not you. But
oh, good.
I mean, I started reading my Book of Mormon again after I left the church because I was like, I want to look at it in a new perspective. And I started reading, and I could not believe how often it was saying, and this and this, and you'll go to hell, and this and this, and hell, and this and hell, and this and hell. And I was like, holy crap. Crap, can we say anything else?
Yeah, Doctrine and Covenants, many of those passages are very much the same.
I just found it completely fascinating, especially given that when Mormons talk about the afterlife, they never say hell. It's,
no. God.
No, it's the celestial, terrestrial kingdoms.
And
then
know,
outer darkness down there, if you deny your... well, the way it was explained to me is... If you have your calling and election made sure, meaning that, you know, God or one of his little minions have appeared to you in person and said, you are going to the celestial kingdom, and you still turn around and deny God, then you go to outer darkness. Otherwise, we go and party in the telestial kingdom.
Yeah.
So.
And oddly enough, so I just recently, Marie and I went through Doctrine and Covenants 76, which sets out the Mormon eschatology, the waves of resurrection, the three different heavens.
Oh, yes.
And it says very explicitly that the telestial kingdom is hell. And but at a later time, Joseph himself said that if you saw the glory of the telestial kingdom, you would kill yourself to get there because it's just that amazing. So like, it's not exactly logically consistent historically speaking, nor is it today when you read about how much they talk about hell, but hell is never a phrase in the Mormon handbook. It's outer darkness, and even that is not very well discussed.
Yeah, and then even with talking about the different kingdoms, they say, well, you're going to end up going to whichever kingdom you're most comfortable in. So it's like, if you're comfortable around the heathens that are going to be kicking it in the telestial kingdom, that's where you're going to go. But
right.
if
yeah.
you're comfortable
who
with the holier than thous that are like doing nothing but making little egg carton decorations and temple work, then you're going to go to the celestial kingdom. So
right. I'm going to whatever kingdom has the party favors in it, right? That's,
yay.
I mean, if as long as somebody is, you know, is holding up in heaven, that's the kingdom I'm comfortable in. But they also say that, like, you can't travel up, but people in the upper kingdoms can travel down, but they're going to feel uncomfortable while they're there. So if you're an apostate child and you're in the telestial kingdom or whatever, and your parents make it to the celestial kingdom, you can't ever go up and visit them, but they can come down and visit you. And, you know...
They won't be angry, just disappointed.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
It's going to be like they visit you at your college dorm. You haven't taken the trash out for 3 weeks, and so it's piled up there. And you've got your stack of dirty laundry there, and they're just kind of looking at it. And they're like, why am I here? Do I need to clean this off before I sit down? Is something going to, you know?
You say this like this is a foreign concept to me.
Yeah, we've all been there. We've all been there when the parents unexpectedly show up. Gotta put things away real quick. Yeah.
So I'm curious, because both of you have this experience. It seems like there's different parental dynamics that go along with being part of this club, so to speak. And it's something that I had no insight to until I met Molly there. So what was that like once, you know, you pulled away the curtain and looked back at it?
I'm going to leave this up to Molly because her experience is much fresher than mine. You know, I've been out for more than a third of my life now. And I left when I was a teenager, so I still had, I only had a teenager's perspective. I didn't continue to flourish as a young adult in the church. So yeah, take that away, Molly.
Like how did looking at my parents after I realized the church was crap?
Yeah, because I know the interactions with your dad especially have been highlighted in a different way just since I've met you. So
yeah,
I'm curious about that.
Well, oh my goodness. Part of this started because, like, I've been on again, off again, going to church for years because, like, I'd go through the cyclical phases where I'm like, oh, I got to be really good and whatever. And, you know, there was a time I was going to church a whole bunch and I was doing good. And then I was called to be the third Sunday Relief Society teacher. But then I didn't feel worthy because I wasn't a virgin. So I talked to the bishop and then he said I was doing okay. And I didn't even have to stop taking the sacrament, right? And so then I'm doing that. Ironically enough, it was the Joseph Smith book when I was teaching the Relief Society on the third Sunday of every month. It was the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith, you know? And I was, and that's been the hardest thing actually, has been my disillusionment with the real Joseph versus what I grew up with. But that's another subject altogether. But then it's like, I was going through these phases. And so when I wasn't going to church, you know, Mom was always calling, well, you need to go to church. Are you reading your Book of Mormon and this kind of stuff? And there were times that she was like, do you not want to talk about church? And I was like, eh, whatever, it's fine. You know, but in that...
in that I'm disappointed
that
in you.
That tone that I'm like, ah, whatever. You know, you talk about it, but, you know. But then... it was, let me see, when a little after I moved here to Pennsylvania, Mom was talking to me, or trying to talk to me, but with my schedule and everything, nothing was coming up, and she kept calling, and I didn't have time to talk. So finally, she wrote me this email, and she said, well, I have something to tell you, you know, and I hadn't told you yet, but before I met your father, I had a child, gave it up for adoption, blah, blah, blah. Oh, by the way, I told your older sister and your younger sister because they were married because I had it on some advice that since you weren't married, I shouldn't tell you.
Whoa.
And that right there severely damaged my relationship with my parents.
I can imagine.
And it was all due to the church.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was so mad and so angry. And it was all because I'm not enough of a person because I wasn't married yet that they couldn't tell me what. and it goes back to the church's attitude about women and, well, you don't count because, you know, you don't have a man. And I almost left the church right then.
I'm surprised you didn't.
Well, here's the kicker. Because I was like, I was responding to them in one sentence emails. I was like, yeah, who gave you this advice? Let me guess, the bishop. And no, it wasn't anyone in the church. It was Dr. Frickin' Laura Schlesinger.
Oh, fuck.
Radio Frickin' Quack.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yes.
Ugh. I got nothing on that.
I have absolutely, like, hated that woman for years because Mom used to listen to her all the time. Same. And she was, I mean, she was always so, I mean, just like Utah Mormons. They were so hoity-toity. She's, like, so full of herself. She knows everything that's best for everybody and whatever. Like, it took months for me to rebuild any semblance of a relationship with my parents. And this was after we already had that awkward time when I told my parents, oh, guess what? I moved in with my boyfriend. So there was that. And then, oh, yeah, you have an older half-sibling. So that damaged it. And then, oh, I'm having a pagan hand fasting and marrying a heathen. Dad, don't ruin my wedding. And then, you know, every time something goes on with either one of my sisters, with the one leaving because of Denver Snuffer's teachings and the other deciding she's going to be a Messianic Jew now, every time something happens with them, Mom calls me up. She's in tears. She's convinced she's a horrible parent. Something she didn't teach us right and all this kind of stuff. And I can't even tell them that I don't believe the church. And
wow. Because you're worried. Is it because you're worried of what it will do to them as your parents?
Yeah, because I'm like, they weren't young when they got married. You know, they were already, in Mormon terms, they weren't young.
So they were like 20, 21, probably. Right?
No, actually, my mom had just turned 30. My dad was 32 when they got married.
Shit.
So
how are they even still people? That's amazing.
Well, I mean, you know, my dad turned 70 last year. Well, let's be realistic. I don't know how long they're going to be around for. And given the insane pressures that the church has and the stigma of if three of your children leave the church, I didn't want their last years, however long they're going to be here, to be filled with, oh, we're such bad parents, we're failures, all our children have left. And so, like, I can't say anything.
And that's kind of something that's really painful about the church's narrative, is they lay the sins of the children onto their parents. You know, if you have any number of kids and any of them fall away, it's seen that it's kind of your fault as the parent, because at some level you failed somewhere that caused them to not believe in the church and apostatize. And it's kind of a common narrative that, you know, eternal punishment is had for those parents who have kids that fall away. And, you know, I just had this family reunion down in near Moab, Utah, and everybody there, every single person there is a believing Mormon, you know, church and temple attending Mormon. And to see kind of the unspoken stigma about how they approach conversations with my sister and I, who are the only black sheep of the extended family, we are the only ones that have left. Yeah, it's definitely a different feeling, and I can tell that it does rub my parents the wrong way to know that all of their extended family have done the right thing and their kids are all attending, but, you know, they must have done something wrong because their kids no longer attend. I kind of credit it with my parents being really good parents and teaching me critical thinking skills, but I don't think they see it as a good thing that way.
That's really interesting, because I think my parents have kind of looked at it the same way, too. I mean, I'm not Mormon, and I never was, but both, you know, how I ended up poly and trans, it's there's that stigma that goes along with it. So I can kind of see where that is, except it's, you know, they got an entire cult supporting them. So,
yeah.
Bryce, what was your getting away story like? I mean, you know, I've heard a lot of Molly's, even some on this show, but, you know, you said you were a teenager, so it's been a long time since you've had to deal with it. But I'm sure even outside of the family reunion, you've had a lot to overcome and deal with just from that stigma.
Well, I'm actually lucky in comparison to most ex-Mormons who leave in that respect, because I did have an older sibling who, you know, transitioned out of the church prior to me. So she had a lot of the fights with my parents that I never had to have, because they just kind of knew that once she went that way, I was probably going to be following in her footsteps. She blazed a trail. So as far as my immediate family goes and my immediate friends go, you know, I had a pretty easy transition out. And, you know, as a teenager, if you're kind of hitting a crossroads as a teenager, either you can continue to follow the church and then go on your mission, go to BYU and get married and have a bunch of kids and then follow the typical Mormon algorithm, or you can call it quits at that point and not come back, or come back when you've gone out into the world and you've learned some things and you realize that the church is true and you'll eventually come back. That's kind of the binary narrative that exists for teenagers that leave the church, or teenagers in the church, or that have a question whether or not they want to continue going. But I had that crossroads moment where I said, I just don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to be a part of this community anymore. I don't want to be a member of this church anymore. And I stopped attending. And it was actually really good, because that gave me Sundays, you know, before I moved out of my parents' basement, it gave me Sundays to sit around the house and think and read books and watch TV shows and, you know, engage in a world that wasn't the church on Sundays. And I also learned some homemaking skills on my own. I did my laundry on Sundays. I cooked food for my family when they would come home from dinner or come home from church every Sunday. I would have the massive Sunday feast ready. So, like, I learned a lot of really useful life skills in that time as soon as I stopped attending church. But I didn't realize that I was doing so at the time. So as far as, you know, any of my relationships after this, leaving the church go, you know, I did feel the cutting off that so many Mormons feel with friends and with family. But by and large, most of those relationships have been nurtured through much time and effort since then, and I've been able to reconcile a lot of the differences that I did attain between these people when I left. And an addition to that is, you're taught in the church when somebody leaves that, or when you leave or something like that, you're going to be berated by people knocking on your door just trying to get you to come back to church. But that simply wasn't the case with me. You know, when I stopped attending, none of my friends, none of my priesthood leaders came over to ask. Nobody came to see what was going on. I just left, and that was it. That was the end of it. I didn't get a call from the bishop or anything. And so, you know, and I also didn't have like a job wrapped up into this. I didn't have my entire life wrapped up into this that was contingent on my staying in the church. So, whereas, you know, a lot of Mormons, especially living in Utah, if you leave the church, you might be saying sayonara to your job and to your kids and your significant other. It's transitioning out as an adult is a lot harder to do than as a teenager, I think. So, yeah. Like I said, I had a really easy go.
See, and that makes me wonder, did you just stop going? Is your name still on the rolls, or did you actually...
I just stopped going. My name is still on the rolls, and I've had a few conversations about whether or not that's a good thing, whether I should send in my letter and have it removed. But when I did this Mormon history tour across the country, I found out that is the reason why I want to keep my name on the rolls, is because if somebody who grew up Jewish, they grew up in an insular society, whatever, they consider themselves culturally Jewish, even if they don't believe in Yahweh anymore. I'm culturally Mormon. I don't believe in the church, but I grew up in the culture. So I don't want to necessarily have my name removed from the culture that, you know, left such a deep impression on me. And when I was, you know, visiting with missionaries out on the history tour at these various Mormon history hotspots, that's when, you know, the first thing that they ask when you come in, oh, where are you from? And I would say Utah, and instantly they get a smile on their face, and oh, are you a member? And then I'd say yes, and that was an honest answer. I am a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, because I haven't removed my name off of the rolls. And you get a completely different experience in talking to Mormons, especially missionaries, when they find out that you are a member of the church. You get the insider's conversation. You're not treated as an outsider, or worse, as an apostate in the conversation. So I found it to be not only beneficial in kind of my own psychological processing of the culture I grew up in, but also beneficial in a way that I can still talk with Mormons at an equal level, and they can't say that, oh, you're an actual apostate, or you've been excommunicated, or you're not a member anymore, because, you know, my name is still on the rolls. I paid them my tithing.
Huh.
See, I find that really interesting when you say that you have not had them come in and knocking at your door and everything like that, because I wasn't here in Pennsylvania for a month before the missionaries were on my front step asking for me by name.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't remember sending you my forwarding address.
Mm-hmm. Family members. It tracks you everywhere you go.
Yeah. And
that's creepy as shit.
That's kind of why I was like, yeah, I'm done. Just erase me.
I totally get that, and there are many more good reasons for ex-Mormons to remove their name from their rolls than there are for keeping their name on the rolls. You know, I talk to a lot of ex-Mormons who have sent in their letter, and they say, when I got the letter back that says that my name has been removed, I had this huge burden lifted. You know, yes. It's like this cloud that was hanging over me and dominating my life, and then the cloud was whisked away, you know, gone with the wind, and that's it. It was a huge psychological benefit for so many people to just know that they are no longer associated with this thing that was, I mean, quite frankly, a cultural cancer on them. So I do see benefits of both, you know, keeping your name on the rolls and removing, and I think the arguments for removing it are better, but I find the benefits in my own perspective to be more compelling to leave my name on the rolls.
That's really fascinating from multiple points of view. Like I can see how it wasn't as like psychologically damaging as it was for Molly to have to deal with that, because, you know, someone kind of took the fire and you know, there wasn't that ostracization. I can speak words. But how do you reconcile some of the negative stigma that goes along with it that comes with being a member of the church? Like, you know, like Prop 8 a couple of years ago, how do you reconcile those things where your tithing goes?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I had stopped paying tithing before Prop 8. I left around that time, actually. You know, I was about 16, 17. That was when I was in high school.
Oh, I thought you had to keep doing so. My fault.
No. So your name is on the roll forever. Even if you don't attend anymore, you don't give your tithing, your name is on the rolls in ink until you send the letter in to have it removed.
Gotcha.
And they do track your address and your forwarding addresses, and they try to get family members to send your information anytime you move, and that's how they were able to find Molly in Pennsylvania. But
so
you know,
weird.
Yeah, it's kind of Orwellian. It's really creepy, and it's, you know, it's a church. It's not a government that's doing it. But if you live in Utah, you would argue that those two are not separate.
One and the same over there. I was so surprised that Utah actually had legalized same-sex marriage before the Supreme Court ruled on it.
Yeah, that does seem very odd to me as well, and I think that probably comes out of Salt Lake City, because the membership numbers in Salt Lake City are dwindling.
Dropping, yeah.
And there are tons of like hip bars and coffee bistros popping up all over. You know, Salt Lake City is kind of a cool teenage city right now. And
I wish I had experienced that part of it. I just got the angry slurry yelling part of it.
Come out in July. We'll hit up some really cool spots.
Okay.
So there are certain stigmas that surround being a member and not having your membership removed. But kind of one reason that I see it, one way that I see it, is the church is led by a geriocracy, a gerontocracy, I think is the actual technical term for it. And these people are people who were born in the 20s and 30s and are still somehow alive today, and they carry the stigmas of their upbringing into the church. And people have been trying to change the church from the outside since its inception. You know, Joseph Smith was actively excommunicating people from his church mere months after he founded it because they were trying to change something from the inside. Then he excommunicated them, and they had to try and either abandon it or change it from the outside. But the church doesn't respond very well to exterior pressures. you know, they eventually get to a point like in 1978 when they said, oh, okay, blacks, yeah, they can have the priesthood. That's totally cool now. But that was, you know, that was when civil rights was hitting a height, when women's rights were hitting a height, when, you know, this was after segregation had been, you know, outlawed 20 years prior almost. And finally, the social pressures got to the point where exterior pressures caused them to change. But they are much more open and inviting to making changes, systematic changes, when people are trying to change them from the inside. And, you know, you reach a certain critical mass with these changes, you know, like Denver Snuffer and Kate Kelly did, people who are trying to change the church's perspective on their history or whatever, and then the church excommunicates them. Well, eventually, somehow, eventually, somewhere inside the ranks of Mormonism, there is going to have to be a systematic change. And the more people that are on their rolls, that are displeased with their current stances on the history or social issues or politics, the more that they're going to have to change in order to retain those numbers. So, you know, I'm all about changing the church, dragging it, kicking and screaming into the 21st century, but I would think that it would be much better to have them change from the inside as kind of a mutually beneficial evolution of this church. Kind of like the Community of Christ did. You know, they have female pastors and women and gay people like giving priesthood blessings and stuff, and they don't think anything of it. The church could go through this evolution. They just don't want to because they're led by a bunch of racist, white, bigoted assholes.
Yeah.
That makes complete sense. Great answer to that question.
You say bring them into the 21st century, and I wonder if they've even reached the 20th yet.
But. Well, you think most of the people who are leading the church, their parents were born in the 1800s.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy to think. So yes, obviously they were given like they were taught the social stigmas that existed from the 1800s, a holdover of the 1800s, and that's what they were raised with. And now, well, we see the product of what has happened now.
Yeah. I'm really fascinated by this. I know I keep saying that, but I cannot get over how there's this world within a world in this part of the country. You know, this was the first time I had visited out in that direction. I had only been west of the Mississippi for the first time this year. So, you know, it's kind of culture shock in more ways than one. And then to be in Utah with someone who was from there, taking me around and showing me things, it was, you know, the culture shock to say the least. But one thing she told me about that I'm curious to hear both of you to elaborate on was she was telling me about the community aid where you could go and ask for food, but then you had to like pay back the money it would take in free labor. Is that true?
Yeah,
that's true.
Wow.
You want to talk on that, Molly?
Yeah. One of my sisters actually had to go on church assistance through the Bishop Storehouse after she and her husband were married. And it was like, this is what your tithing is partially for, is to help the members when they're financially struggling.
Yeah.
Not just with food, but with like actual financial bills for rent, for this, for that, you know. But the way they had to go about doing it was completely humiliating. She had to go in and sit down with the bishop with their full, all their finances. And they'd go through it and say, well, can you cut this? Can you cut this? Can you, you know, stop this? Have you asked your family for help? So they would make them go and beg their family for money before they would help them with their own tithing money, which they pay in. Like, that's the point of the tithing, is to help them out. But they'd have to go and, you know, beg mom and dad and me and Diane for stuff. And then after that, when they said, okay, we'll help with this, like, if you go to the Bishop's Storehouse for food, part of the thing that they want you to do is go and work in the cannery after or before or whatever. And so, you know, you go and you help, you get the big 50-pound bags of wheat and rice and whatever, and you go and you get the number 10 cans and you fill it with the right amount, and then you have the special lid you put on top and it's got a hole in it, because then you have this tube, you've got to blow some air in there to make sure it's not settled wrong, and then they go and they slap the right lid on, and then they run it around, and then they put the label, and then you have to do that with all these bags of food that are there so that the shelves are replenished after you've gone and taken some stuff out. So, yeah.
And it does, like, so the very foundation of Mormonism, and this is product of Sidney Rigdon being a member of the church primarily, they were very communalistic in many respects. They founded this thing called the United Firm and the Bishop's Storehouse, where basically all of the possessions of the early saints, this is, you know, Joseph Smith's era, they paid in all of their possessions, and then the church would handle all of their possessions and distribute them as they saw fit. Now, of course, there were a myriad of people who were opposed to this, and
they like to call it the law of consecration, and they like to tell you that, oh, well, you know, once everybody has learned their lesson and they're not so greedy, we're going to live this again.
Yeah, so you consecrate your properties to the bishop's storehouse, essentially. So that's the law of it. But the way that it's made its manifestation nowadays, because so many Mormons are, you know, very opposed to the idea of communism, even though that is in their, you know, all of their religious texts, they have what is, you know, the church's welfare program. And you are, you know, as you said, Molly, you're required to go sit down with your bishop and show him your finances and say, we need help for this. But they also require you to continue paying your tithing at that time. And you pay that 10% on everything you get. So, and
oh my
gosh. This recently, there was a headline that recently made the news in our skeptical and atheist movement. It was a church talk. It was a conference talk from one of the elders saying that even if your kids are starving, you pay your tithing. Like, that's the very first thing that you do. And people were surprised.
I wrote a blog about that.
Yeah, and people are surprised to hear it, but it's like, that was just normal shit to you and me, Molly, right? Yeah. Like, we'd heard those stories all of, like, our life growing up.
Yeah, that's the way you exercise your faith, because, you know, God's not going to bless you and provide for your needs until you make that sacrifice and turn in your tithing. And then, magically, here will be this check, or then your neighbor's going to come by with food for the family. Here's a casserole.
And and it's a self-perpetuating cycle, right? If you're giving 10% of everything you have to the church, and then you are seeking help from the church's welfare program and still paying in that 10%, you know, that 10% could go to, you know, buying school supplies for your children, or, you know, buying food, or, you know, maybe getting out of the house once in a great, great while to have some entertainment that's not just church and at home. Instead, you're devoting that 10% of your non-expendable income to the church and still getting help from the church. So it's kind of a negative feedback loop, and every member of the church knows that the safety net is there. And don't get me wrong, the church's welfare program is awesome when they actually help people. But when they require them to work as, you know, slave labor for their food, and they require them to humiliate themselves and show their financials to their bishop when bishops are typically more affluent members of the neighborhood, you know, it's kind of disgusting, and it's an entire psychological game when you lay it out that way. And especially when we wrap all of this into the fact that the church isn't actually a church. It's a multi-billion-dollar multinational corporation. They can afford to, you know, not take in 10% of somebody's, you know, a really poor family's money for a little while until they get back on their feet, but they still require that of them in order for them to get help from the welfare program. It's really insidious and sinister once you get down to the bare bones of it.
Yeah, my first reaction was, isn't this indentured servitude? Like,
that's exactly what it is. Yes.
How is this legal?
Because it's a church, and churches can do whatever the fuck they want. That's how it's legal.
Yeah, and as soon as they say, okay, well, you don't have to pay your tithing right now, oh, but if you don't, we're going to take your temple recommend. Yep. And then,
which means that we're making it so you can't go to heaven. Like, let's also say the importance of having a temple recommend. If you don't have that, you don't get to heaven. So if they do something that takes away your temple recommend, they are taking away your exaltation.
Wow.
So, yeah, everything that you do in the church obviously has eternal consequences, and it just so happens that, you know, that dentist down the street who is your bishop happens to be the person who actively does these punishments, you know, and it causes a neighborhood, a society to police itself in that aspect. It's a cult. I think that's what we can boil this whole conversation down is. It really is a cult.
Yeah, and it's kind of like prosperity preachers before they were cool, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah. Joe was the prosperity hipster, I'm telling you.
Wow. I mean, we've gone way over time, and I love it, but we didn't even get to the silly book. this has been one of the most fascinating conversations I've ever had.
Well, and now you might see why I got so interested in Mormonism in general. Once I left and I started studying it and realizing that, you know, the pond of Mormonism may not be very broad, but it's deep as fuck. Like, you dive in and there you can explore every nook and cranny and crevice of this pond, and you will never truly get to the bottom. And that's just with the history. Once you loop in current day politics and modern revelation and modern Mormonism, it's an entire world. I think you said this, Riss, like, it's a world within a world. It's really crazy to take a peek into.
Yeah.
It's the Mariana Trench of religion.
It's true.
Molly, you should end it right there. That was brilliant.
Right? And cut.
Okay. So, we shall wrap up this episode, but, dear listeners, you should come back for more, because on our next episode, Bryce is going to talk to us about the Willie and Martin handcart companies because Pioneer Day is coming up.
It is.
170th anniversary.
Wow.
But yeah, we'll get more on that next episode. So, yay.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me for this episode. It's fun.
Well, thank you for coming on. All right. I'd like to thank Bryce Blankenengel of the Naked Mormonism podcast for joining us. I had a blast talking with him. He was so patient through all the technical difficulties I was having with my audio randomly dropping out. He's just a really great guy, and it was awesome recording with him. If you haven't heard his show, and face it, you really should, because it's fascinating. You can find him at NakedMormonismPodcast.com. If you liked this week's episode, be sure to listen next week when Bryce returned to talk Pioneer Day and the Willie and Martin Handcart Companies. But for now, good night.